those links to the fossil fuel industry, even though they say they've divested. It's clear that big oil isn't toxic. It isn't radioactive in terms of its reputation as perhaps the tobacco industry may be. All these progressive institutions are very happy to work with those aligned with big oil if they feel that they can get something out of that.
And can you talk about big tech, Oliver?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it may not surprise some people who are a little cynical about big tech's pronouncements on things like climate change, but it's still quite extraordinary that you have these large companies that have vowed to do so much to address the climate crisis. Apple, for example, has vowed to kind of decarbonize its entire supply chain by 2030, and yet it shares lobbyists with the Koch network. Amazon employs fossil fuel aligned lobbyists in 27 different states. Microsoft lobbyist also works for Exxon on other days of the week. Google has a lobbyist with seven different fossil fuel clients. I mean, the list goes on and on. This is an industry that has been called out several times for under-delivering on its promises on the climate crisis. And it's clear that the wielding of political power and influence is far more important to them than staying true to any kind of ideals of distancing themselves fully from the fossil fuel industry.
I want to quickly get to insurance industry. You tweeted, some of these overlaps are particularly jarring. State Farm, which is halting new policies in California due to wildfires, has fossil fuel-aligned lobbyists in 18 states. Top ski resorts and their melting snow also pay for oil and gas lobbyists. Knowing this information, can you talk about the significance of State Farm halting new housing insurance policies in California and employing lobbyists who also work for carbon polluters?
Yeah, I mean, some of this doesn't seem just to be a kind of conflict of interest. It seems to be going actively against the interests of the companies that are paying these lobbyists. I mean, State Farm, like you say, they announced in May that they'll be taking no more homeowner policies in California due to what they call the kind of growing catastrophic risk of wildfires. And yet they employ these fossil fuel lobbyists all across the US. It seems to be actively working against their own financial interests. They're paying people to helping other companies create the pollution that they then have to pay for when it comes to insurance premiums due to wildfires and floods and other huge climate disasters. And ski resorts too really seemed quite surprising to me. I was very kind of interested to see that you have these top ski resorts like Vail and Jackson Hole that have lobbyists that also work for fossil fuel interests, given the existential risk that global heating causes to the ski industry due to melting snow and glacier loss and so on. So, it's really quite surprising to see these kind of overlaps. And until now, we didn't know about it. There wasn't this transparency until now. Now it's been revealed, and maybe some action might be taken.
Finally, Oliver Millman, what are the universities from Bard to Johns Hopkins to University of Washington, et cetera, and the environmental groups saying about these shared fossil fuel lobbyists?
There's two kind of main defenses. One is, you know, it's quite normal for lobbyists to have lots of different clients. This is just the way the business is done, which is a kind of maybe a kind of cynical and grubby way of looking at politics, but probably a realistic one. The other one is that it's actually beneficial. Some of the green groups told me, well, if you have a fossil fuel lobbyist, they will help connect you to politicians who you wouldn't normally talk to. A Republican politician might not take your call if you're the Environmental Defense Fund, but if you have a fossil fuel lobbyist who they do speak to, you can gain access through them. It's a way of gaining access to those in power, which, again, you might see as a kind of a cynical way of looking at things, but is the way things are done in state capitals and, of course, in Washington, D.C., too.
Oliver Millman, environmental reporter at The Guardian, whose new investigation is headlined, Double Agents, Fossil Fuel Lobbyists Work for U.S. Groups Trying to Fight Climate Crisis. We'll link to the piece at democracynow.org. Next up, we go to Guatemala City, where election officials have rejected an attempt by the ruling business and political elite to overturn results from the first round of a presidential election where the progressive anti-corruption candidate came in second in a shock to almost all, the race leading to an August 20th runoff. Stay with us. Mother. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn to major developments in Guatemala, where election officials have rejected an attempt by the ruling business and political elite of Guatemala to overturn the results of last month's first round of the presidential election. The race is heading to a runoff August 20th between the former First Lady, Sandra Torres, and the progressive anti-corruption candidate, Bernardo Arevalo, who's also a member of Guatemala's Congress. The review of ballots came after the party of Sandra Torres, who's been accused of corruption, and her allies, challenged the results of June's first round of elections. A spokesperson for Guatemala's electoral court said in an interview with Reuters Thursday, the final results of the first round election have not changed after the review and will officially be released next week. But the elite sector still refused to accept the results, as fear mounts they'll continue to interfere in the election leading up to the runoff. Protests erupted in Guatemala City earlier this week after the Constitutional Court suspended the certification of the results, which put Bernardo Arevalo of the Semilla Party, which Semilla means seed, in second place, sending him to that presidential runoff against Sandra Torres, the frontrunner. Rights groups denounce the court's decision as anti-democratic. This is an attorney for the Semilla Party.
What is clear is that the slogan of the official party, supported by parties close to the ruling party, is to manage to open as many boxes as possible that will allow them to declare the electoral process null and void so that the election can be repeated.
Bernardo Arevalo is the son of the former Guatemalan president, Juan José Arevalo, Guatemala's first democratically elected president. He pushed for a revolution. Revolutionary social reforms when he was in office from 45 to 51. Bernardo Arevalo spoke to supporters in Guatemala City after the first round of the election led to his surprise second place finish.
We will fight corruption, because if we do not fight corruption, we will not achieve development and fight poverty. The persecution of the press is a symptom of the deterioration that this country is suffering under this authoritarian regime. We will fight persecution of the press and harassment of anyone of their ideas or dissent. We will guarantee freedom of expression, freedom of the press, and freedom of protest.
For more, we go to Guatemala City, where we're joined by Samuel Perez Alvarez, Guatemalan Congress member who is Secretary General of the Progressive Guatemalan Political Party, Semilla. He was elected to Guatemala's Congress in 2020. Welcome to Democracy Now! So there's all sorts of internecine squabbles within the ruling political and business elite right now. First, were you shocked by your own candidate coming in second? And can you talk about what this means for Guatemala? And if you expect, though it is expected that the elite will seek further recounts, annulment, that this runoff will happen on August 20th?
Yes, of course, we were surprised by the results, but it was logical that this all this elite and this like corruption regime were going to give fight against us, because this review of the ballots, it was just an excuse that because they were saying that we manipulated the results in order to commit fraud. But it was impossible for us to do that because we have no economic resources. We didn't have candidates all over the country, and we are relatively a new political party. So it was really difficult for us to compete in this election. And now they are saying that we manipulated the results. So it was game changing for Guatemala. A political perspective. It is the first time that this happens.
So can you talk about what Semilla represents and what it would mean if Bernardo Arevalo became president of Guatemala, what he ran on his platform?
Well, we are a social democratic party, but we have some priorities that maybe that scares some political elites or economic elites. We have some priorities that will take us some time to solve here in Guatemala, because we have this democracy, it isn't at its best. So the first thing is that we're going to fight against corruption. And that means like a big administrative reform of the state. The second thing is having a market that works for all. So we plan to pass the first antitrust legislation in the history of Guatemala. And that is breaking all these market concentration monopolies and everything and market imperfections. So that is maybe the most scary things for economic elites here in Guatemala. And the third thing is a massive investment in health, in education, social security, and public services.
Can you talk about the history of U.S. intervention and how that has led to where we are today? We were just mentioning that Bernardo Arevalo's father, Juan José Arevalo, first democratically elected president of Guatemala, what, from 45 to 51, in 1954, the U.S., backing United Fruit, overthrew the Guatemalan president, Arbenz, leading to a number of military regimes, the massacres of people, particularly indigenous in the Northwest Highlands of Guatemala, and how that has brought us to today, to Giamaté, the current president, who we just heard Bernardo Arevalo talking about the authoritarian government, and what you think needs to change, and particularly what should the U.S. be doing, what role the U.S. should be playing.
Well, yes, it is important for us because Juan José Arevalo was the first democratically elected president here in Guatemala. He won against a regime of military dictatorships. And now Bernardo will win against a regime of corruption dictatorship. I think that we have historical justice and Guatemalan people on our side. And we know that we have a social democratic legacy, but we are now looking forward. And we're expecting to have a pacific but strong government against corruption and authoritarian ways. But we know that we have now a polarized society. And it is time to put an end to that.
And can you talk about Giamaté when it comes to corruption? I mean, when you have what is known as the Pactos Corruptos, the political and business ruling elite in Guatemala, how they banned presidential candidates. It seems like they didn't bother to ban Bernardo Arevalo because they never realized he would come in second, leading to this runoff against the former First Lady Sandra Torres.
Well, actually, I'm not sure if Giamaté's presidency is the most corrupt president in history, but it sure is the most shameless. They have no legitimacy, no social nor economic results for the people, not even the intention to solve them some minor problems. So it's all about two things for them: stealing everything they could and seeking for impunity by selecting and protecting their judges. Semilla arises actually from a wave of protest against corruption and all the authoritarian ways. We have been speaking up in Congress against this political prosecution, and which had we have been victims in the past also, and in favor of freedom of speech and many other human rights. So it's very important for us, this election.
Can I ask you about the attacks on activists, on opposition, also on the press, the El Periodico, and the founder, Jose Rubén Zamora, just sentenced to 6 years in prison. And what this means, the Guatemalan court in June convicting him of money laundering in what rights groups have condemned as a trumped-up case, part of a crackdown on press freedom. Zamora, founder and president of this investigative journalism website.
Yes, it is, because this regime is not only corrupt, but authoritarian. So it's not the first symptom of this authoritarian regime getting to power, because we have no freedom of speech. They buy this, all these congressmen and congresswomen in Congress. So there is no Republican balances, check and balances here in Guatemala. So it is not only a political saying that we are living in a corruption dictatorship. So we have to put an end to that, because we have a really polarized society, and it is because of political decisions.
And can you talk about how corruption and this authoritarianism leads to greater migration and the role of the U.S. when it comes to shoring up the Guatemalan government in exchange for stopping that migration?
Well, actually, some of the consequences of this corruption elite leading the country is that they do not have any plan for anything but for stealing public money. So the economic strategy is not working for anyone here in Guatemala. So the consequences are migration, but also the increases of violence, of inequality, of poverty. So every time we measure poverty, it's every time higher. And that is also political decisions. So that is why they have no legitimacy in power. So they might have the constitutional court, the electoral authority, the Congress, the executive power, but they do not have the most important majority, which is the people's majority.
And there have been protests around the political and government elite trying to head off this runoff, stop Arévalo from running. Are you concerned about them initiating street violence?
The street violence?
Violence in the streets.
Yes, well, maybe, because I'm not sure if they are going to win this one, because people are not supporting. Actually, I think the review of these ballots, it was their second plan, their secondary plan. If it had came out for them, everything will be different now, but it was a big failure for them. It was, I would say, humiliating for them, because in the public eye, with all the media watching and our brave teams fighting for a fair review, we ended up having more votes than we were originally announced. And it wasn't a lot, but a couple of thousand of votes that they typed it wrong. So we are now stronger than ever. So I'm not sure if they're going to be stopping Bernardo from running for the second round.
Samuel Perez Alvarez, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Guatemalan Congressmember, head of the Progressive Political Party, Semilla. Of course, we'll continue to follow what happens this summer. Next up, it's the 10th anniversary of the coup in Egypt that ousted its first democratically elected president. We'll speak with Shadi Hamid about lessons for the next Arab Spring. Stay with us. We'll be right back. is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we end today's show looking at this 10th anniversary of the 2013 coup in Egypt, when General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi removed Egypt's first democratically elected president from power, then led a purge of Muslim Brotherhood government leaders and a crackdown on dissent. Lessons for the Next Arab Spring is the headline of a new piece by Shadi Hamid, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, author of The Problem of Democracy, America, the Middle East, and the Rise and Fall of an Ideal. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. If you can start off by laying out what we now know about the role of the U.S., particularly of President Obama, in response to the coup.
Yep. Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me. So Washington was directly complicit. And I think up until relatively recently, and certainly right after the coup 10 years ago, there was a sense that the U.S. was caught off guard, that the Obama administration wanted to do the right thing, but didn't know how, and they didn't really have leverage. And that sort of kind of innocent bystander theory where America acts like, you know, oh, what could we do? We're only the superpower of the world. You know, in recent years, more and more information has come out that suggests that the U.S. played a quite negative role in the months and days leading up to the July 3rd, 2013 military coup. And, you know, in my piece and in the book from which it's adapted, The Problem of Democracy, I interviewed around 30 former and current senior U.S. officials and was able to get some spicy information on certain key moments in those final days, and it's not a positive picture. And I do argue explicitly that Washington and Obama in particular gave what amounted to a green light to the Egyptian military to proceed with the coup. We could have done quite a bit more to stop it. We could have threatened an immediate aid suspension before the coup happened. And even after the coup happened, there was a chance to declare it a coup and cut assistance. And that's what U.S. law requires in any coup d'etat where the military plays a decisive role. It is a legal obligation to cut aid. Of course, President Obama got away from that or avoided that by not declaring it a coup. So there are a number of these different things that, you know, when you sort of piece them together, we can't really say that the U.S. didn't know what was going on. And in fact, some senior officials, in particular John Kerry, was actually quite enthusiastic about the coup. And there was this very memorable phrase where he said that Abdel Fattah al-Sisi was, quote unquote, restoring democracy. He said this after two massacres of Muslim Brotherhood supporters.
I mean, your piece is really interesting, and I just want to read from it because it really tells people how, you know, the government works. You write, a White House advisor who was there walked me through how the conversation unfolded. He said, I came in all hot and bothered, and so did a few others, that there was a clear letter of the law that said, declare the coup, cut off military assistance. Actually, we weren't even focused on the first thing, because only somebody who was purposefully obfuscating what would say that it wasn't a coup. So it was like, when do we announce this? That's when I came in, expecting the conversation was going to be about that. And then Obama, for the only time that I can recall in the years I work for him, the only time he came in and said, well, so we're not going to declare this a coup, so what should we do? I was totally taken aback by that, and so were many other people, and so it completely changed the tenor of the conversation. I mean, this is fascinating. I don't know if you want to reveal now who it was who was talking to you, but explain what this means and why you think Obama took this stance and what now this has meant. I mean, we're talking about thousands of people imprisoned, political prisoners.
Yeah, and it's really worth underscoring what kind of how this is such a moral stain on the Obama administration's legacy. I do consider the coup to be the day that the Arab Spring ended. After that, there was no hope of getting back. I mean, Egypt is the most populous country in the region. Egypt sets the tone. So this was not just a minor thing. This was decisive, and I hope it will be remembered in that way. And that quote, just hearing you read it back to me, I still find it remarkable. I mean, I can't share who it was because that's not the sort of thing this person would want to be known for. But it is really remarkable. And as for the reasons behind it, I think there's a couple things going on here. Obama also had this very pragmatic side to him where he would say, well, you know, if a coup already happened, let me try to do business with the people who are in power. Let me try to get things done. I don't want too much headache of some big pro-democracy agenda. Let's also keep in mind that Obama, when he assumed the presidency, wanted to distance himself from the Bush administration's so-called freedom agenda. So there was always a kind of discomfort with a very strong emphasis on democracy promotion. But I think there's actually a darker undercurrent where Obama, after some initial enthusiasm for the Arab Spring when it started in 2011, he gets very disillusioned very quickly. And one of the things I discuss at length in the book is the sorts of things that Obama would say privately and even sometimes publicly about Arabs and Muslims. And there was that famous Atlantic profile from 2016 that reported that Obama was known to privately joke, quote unquote, "All I need in the Middle East is a few smart autocrats." He also had another joke where he would say he would wonder out loud why people in the Middle East can't be just like the Scandinavians. So there was this sense of like, why can't the Muslims get their act together? Why are they always fighting? And Obama almost felt betrayed because he supported the Arab Spring, or at least he thought he did in the beginning. And then he kind of went and said, well, was I right to support it if it led to all this civil conflict and all these clashes between different parties and ideological orientations? And of course, let's remember, too, that Obama wanted to pivot away from the Middle East. So there was a sense that he was always being dragged back in. And I think at some point there was just a sense of, well, maybe if they were all autocrats, things would be a lot easier. And then just the last thing is we have a democratic dilemma in the Middle East. We like democracy in theory, but we don't like democracy's outcomes in practice. Why? Because it's Islamist parties that tend to win elections, or at least do quite well in them, when elections are held in the Middle East. And the coup was committed against a Muslim Brotherhood-led government. Here's an Islamist party that believes that Sharia or Islamic law should play a central role in public life. And then we as Americans are just instinctually uncomfortable with that. We think democracy should lead to good outcomes, but when it leads to Islamist outcomes, we struggle with that.
Well, Shadi Hamid, I want to thank you for being with us, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. We'll link to your new piece in Foreign Policy, Lessons for the Next Arab Spring, the book that he's authored, The Problem of Democracy, America, the Middle East, and the Rise and Fall of an Idea. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Gozda, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Charina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen Hani Masood, and Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. This is democracynow.org.
Open Mic on CJSF 90.1 is where you can listen to fresh new releases. From any genre, any day of the week. Visit cjsf.ca for the latest open mic schedule.
And now for a CJSF Heritage Minute. During the 80s and the 90s, CJSF would come into its own as a serious platform for independent artists and a forum for people to express ideas not present in the mainstream media. Summer 2002, CJSF receives a license from the Canadian Radio Telecommunications Commission to broadcast over the FM airwaves. February 13th, 2003, 7 p.m. CJSF goes on air at 90.1 FM, and we've been changing the sound of radio in Burnaby ever since.